The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
There were signs all over the trenches, Piccadilly Circus and Regent Street and all that sort of thing.
Documentary masterpiece or historical sacrilege? We'll talk about the acclaimed World War I film They Shall Not Grow Old and the practice of colourising and transforming historic footage. Also...
My schools are beginning to be of service to a great many parts of the world. If I could be of service in saving souls in any part of the globe, I would be willing to do all in my power.
The life and legacy of an education pioneer, Nano Nagel, who founded the Presentation Order of Nuns, and how the order and its schools spread around the globe. Plus...
Frightened a pound of carrots.
£2 of chops, no, for 50 pence.
Onions are carrots.
Dublin Markets, we preview an upcoming conference on the long and varied history of markets in our capital city. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. We begin this evening with the subject of colourising and transforming historic footage. Peter Jackson's recent World War I documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old, has received much critical acclaim in recent months. The documentary is made up of footage from the period of British troops on the Western Front, footage sourced from the archives of the Imperial War Museum in London. Using colourisation, a new soundtrack and other technical efforts, the film overlays vibrant colour and sound on the old, familiar, silent black and white. It received rave reviews from most critics and was hailed for humanising the soldiers in the archive film and bringing to life their experiences in the trenches. But some historians, archivists and critics aren't entirely comfortable with the way the film has been presented. Tonight on the show, we're going to explore some of the objections to the approach taken by Peter Jackson in his much-celebrated film. And we're going to hear first from the head of the Irish Film Institute's Irish Film Archive, Cassandra O'Connell. Earlier, she spoke to Lorcan Clancy.
We were aware that there was sort of a nasty feeling between England and Germany. We knew of the Kaiser's ambitions to expand his empire and all that sort of thing.
The first 25 minutes or so of They Shall Not Grow Old is mostly original black and white footage showing the lead up to the war. It has that grainy and sped up quality often associated with older film.
Here is where it merges very smoothly into colour. To me, it feels a little bit unreal. They almost look like watercolours.
Follow me!
You got the order, load. And you always went into the line prepared to use your rifle immediately.
The rest of the footage used in the film has been augmented with modern production techniques, like adjusting the frame rate to make people's movement seem smoother and more lifelike. But the colourisation of this footage is one thing that has proven controversial among film historians and archivists.
I'm used to looking at black and white footage, and I always have issues with the ethics around changing something too much. I would really see the film, the documentary as they call it, as a new work of art, as opposed to a more authentic version of what actually happened.
There would be perhaps two or three sentry groups in the whole company's front.
The film has been described as a restoration. For Cassandra, that word is being applied inaccurately.
In terms of the Peter Jackson film, I know that they use the word restoration a lot. And this is something that I find is bandied about a lot when it comes to archival footage. From an archival perspective, there may have been some restoration done, but the colourisation certainly isn't restoration because you're not restoring it back to anything. You're creating something new. So I can see it from two points of view. I find it very interesting in a historical context because it was actually the colourisation of films older, the older canon of Hollywood in the 1980s by Ted Turner that led to the National Film Preservation Movement spearheaded by Martin Scorsese because they were so outraged that this canon of Hollywood films was going to be culturally vandalised by this media mogul. So it's really interesting to see now that you have a very well-established, very well-respected film archive working with a director to take material and have colourised it to great critical acclaim. Colourisation has been around since the start of film. People have been using it as a tool to enhance their work artistically, and it's something that works really well. But call it what it is. Don't call it a restoration. It's an artistic medium.
Your rigid orders. No talking whatsoever. Keep your head down. No smoking. The captain would then direct you right to the front trenches.
There's no narration in the film. The voices heard are interviews with former soldiers recorded in the 1960s, recounting their experiences of battles and everyday life in the trenches.
When a man goes into trenches, he usually carries a roll of barbed wire or a bag of bombs, besides his own equipment.
But there's another layer to the soundtrack that aims to make what you're watching more immediate. Forensic lip readers deciphered what was being said by the men in the silent footage, and actors recorded the lines so they'd match up exactly.
Smile, say your mother thinks I'm looking after you. Up you go. Double up, double up!
I think the thing that makes this work better is the soundtrack, because they are real people. And the sound effects as well. They far more than the colourisation. From a viewer's point of view, I found the sound to be the more immediate and the thing that really breathes life into the footage.
Watch yourself.
Come along.
The other thing that kind of bothers me about the film is they talk about this restoration as if the film was in really terrible condition. And the Imperial War Museum had done restorations on the film that was used in 2006 and 2013. So they were already in pretty good condition. I mean, they'd been screened in the cinemas in 2016. So, you know, they were obviously palatable to audiences. But the reality of restoration is that it is exactly what the word says. You're trying to restore something back to its original, not to make it better than the original. Just like you wouldn't take the Book of Kells and go, well, we can make these colours a bit brighter, or we can, you know, that is the ethical basis of it, and it's no different with a film.
You live like tramps. You didn't polish any buttons and nobody worried. All they were concerned with was that you were fit to fight.
It's very much making a new work, a new way to engage audiences with the original content. And that's exactly what I think Jackson did with this. And in that end, it absolutely works. But it does do a disservice to the archivists who worked on the original restoration and who've preserved it for the last 100 years. And then also the original cameramen who aren't mentioned anywhere. So Mallins and McDowell, who were the two guys who actually went and shot all this amazing footage and were the directors really, because there wasn't a director, they're completely written out of history as well, which I think is a little bit unfair. To use that word authenticity, I think the authenticity is gone. I mean, there's something about the grainy footage. It makes you really realise, wow, this really happened 100 years ago.
And that was Cassandra O'Connell, their head of the IFAI Irish Film Archive. And she was speaking to our producer, Lorcan Clancy, and giving her take on Peter Jackson's film, They Shall Not Grow Old. We've been tweeting out some clips of the documentary on our Twitter account, at RTE History Show, if you want to see what we're talking about. And I should say that we asked some of our followers on Twitter what they thought of They Shall Not Grow Old. The vast majority used superlative after superlative, saying, I loved it, extraordinary. Ordinary, stunning, heartbreaking, amazing, and one man who kept it short and simply said, wow. So, between the majority of film critics and many who watched the film, there was a very positive reaction to Peter Jackson's reimagining of this historic footage. Tonight, we're going to hear some very different perspectives. As we've heard in that opening piece, not everyone was comfortable with some of the processes used and with the results. I'm joined in studio by three guests with me in Dublin. Orla Fitzpatrick, a photo historian and librarian at the National Museum of Ireland, and Lara Joy, Port Heritage Director in Dublin Port. And in our Cork studio is Ciara Chambers, Head of Film and Screen Media at University College Cork. You're all very welcome indeed. Lara, start with you. You actually liked the digital effects. You don't have a huge problem with the project as, you know, with the final product, as it were.
Yeah, well, with colourisation, what I find, we would have done it previously when I worked at the National Museum of Ireland, colourisation allows you to see photographs in a different way, and you pick up on things that you would have missed in the black and white. And that's why I found from this film, the film is that Peter Jackson did is based on two very famous films made in 1916, which is The Battle of the Somme, followed up by The Battle of Ancre, which were was basically July and September, October of 1916 and those events. And that's what he's done. He's taken those two films, he's colourised the bits, and he's kind of created his own narrative. And I would know those two films very well, having lectured on them in black and white, but now you start to see different pieces, especially in relation to the harsher parts of war, the horror. And I think that's what Peter Jackson's trying to show, is the bodies, the destruction, and they're the kind of things that you pick up. But Cassandra is right. I mean, one of the key things is the use of sound, because suddenly you're now starting to see the films in a different way. So from that point of view, yeah, the colorization does bring it to a different level.
But these were essentially propaganda films. Malins and McDowell were certainly not allowed to film anything that the government or the military would not like to have them film, and a lot of the footage was faked.
That's the issue I would have, is this historical, less maybe so the colour. He is essentially taking propaganda film, and he's 100 years later telling us the same story that was created in 1916 for a particularly British audience. In these films, they show a lot of dead bodies. About 8% of the films show dead bodies. They're trying to show the horror of the war. And what they were trying to do to an English or British audience at the time was to encourage men who hadn't joined up to go and fight, because this had to be stopped. So to modern audience, to see dead bodies on screen is unusual, but in 1916 they were using this to shock people. And I think in many ways he's kind of fallen into the trap that he's kind of still pushing that agenda.
I should be, or perhaps I shouldn't be, utterly pedantic, but obviously the title is taken from the Laurence Binion poem, and the poem is actually "They Shall Grow Not Old." But that's Sarah Carey pointed that out on Twitter yesterday as well. Maybe I'm being utterly pedantic, but as a photo historian, Orla, you've got strong opinions on colorization. Talk to us a bit about the practice of colorizing photos and film, and how you feel about it with regard to Peter Jackson's film.
Well, as Cassandra said, colourisation always existed from the beginning of photography, but I'm quite keen to see photography and cinema used as a primary source. So I feel that we treat it slightly differently than we would, say, the written word, and the idea that you would maybe try and modernise the poets of World War One or letters from the front and make them, you know, modern. So I think there's a lot of dubious phrases put out there about the truth in photography, and that idea, the intervention in the archive being something that makes it more real. So for me, I think the audience and the general public are sophisticated enough to react to black and white pictures. I feel that the colour, whilst it has improved, I still think slightly a little off real. Everybody's got the same skin tone, same rosy cheeks, and at first it seemed like a blast of reality in the film, but then it very much turns into a sameness that's a little bit surreal and probably like early Technicolor. So
he also manipulates some of the material by doing something that Malins and McDowell didn't do, which is going into quite extreme close-ups on some of the soldiers. And I think at that point, does it begin to fall down? Does it begin to fall apart a little bit? Because they look a bit strange. They look like waxwork dummies almost.
Well, I think the film resolution is not capable of taking that. So it does have a bit of dissolve and a little bit of breakaway, which I think, you know, the close-up wasn't a tactic used at that time. So it very much is overlaying contemporary ideas of how we look on top of that, and I don't know whether it works or not. I think people would react very favourably to this footage on the large screen in black and white.
Perhaps treated in the same way as it was treated.
Exactly.
So do everything else with it. In other words, digitise it so that these weird sort of jerky movements that we see in the 1916 footage doesn't exist, and the sound. Are you okay with all of that?
I suppose it really is this idea of the photograph as a primary source document, and the reason that it looks a certain way is because of the technologies that were available at the time. And I think we could do a lot to educate the visual literacy of people, and so that people know what they're responding to. And I think if you look at how people responded to, say, the 1916 commemorations, we didn't need to colourise Pierce or O'Connell Street's destruction. So there is very much, people are capable of taking different technologies and the idea that things looked different at different times.
Yeah, I wouldn't
times
be looking forward
board.
To the colourised version of Misha Era, for example,
no.
or Saoirse, or either of those. Ciara in Cork, Ciara Chambers, you could make the argument that 1916 audiences, and these films were shown to literally hundreds of thousands of people in 1916, that they were seeing World War One in the prevailing technological film language of the day, if I can use a phrase like that, while with the Jackson version, we, a modern audience, are seeing it in a 2018 vernacular. Is that a valid point, do you think?
Yes, I think that's a very valid point, and this is exactly the concern that's been raised by many of the critics of the film, even though it has been overwhelmingly praised. Those who have raised concerns about it have suggested exactly that, that these films were screened for an audience in the cinema, in black and white, in the pre-sound era, accompanied by music. They're now screened for a 21st century audience, and they've been updated in a way that takes them very, very far from that original context. And this is where some of the criticism comes in, that we can't trust modern audiences with archival black and white footage, that it has to be energised for them in a particular way, that it has to be presented to them in a more dramatic and entertaining way. And it's perhaps unfair for us to assume that audiences can't engage with the original black and white films, because as Laura knows, and as I know, when we talk about this in the classroom, in lectures, often students respond in overwhelmingly fascinated ways to consider particularly the propaganda element of these films and why they were produced. So that context is a little bit lost in Jackson's film, because he doesn't credit the original filmmakers, and we don't know in the credits the films that have been used. And those, as Laura has already pointed out, those films have a hugely important context of their own. The Battle of the Somme is infamous, of course, and associated with fakery. Well, that's a fascinating context that many audiences won't be aware of when they're watching Peter Jackson's film, because the Battle of the Somme is never mentioned anywhere.
Now, but you could also make the argument that colour photography existed, still photography existed. And, I mean, there's an entire book called the First World War in Colour. And so it's just the case that Malins and McDowell did not have the advantage of having colour photography, and Peter Jackson has introduced that now at this stage, because it did exist at the time.
It did. There were techniques that were available at the time, hand painting techniques on film that were used for individual shots, for inserts, but there are other limitations that Jackson doesn't have to deal with, that Malins and McDowell had. So they couldn't get close to the action. The camera in the 1910s was cumbersome, it was big, it was dangerous for them to get close to the action, which is why they recreated some of the scenes in the Battle of the Somme. They also, the close-up wasn't something they used, and that's why the close-up in this context is so surreal, as Orla has pointed out. Many critics have commented that the faces sort of bend and buckle in strange ways under this intense digital manipulation, and that has put some viewers off. And obviously there's a difference in terms of those who've seen it in 3D in the cinema and those who've watched it on television, but there is a sense of a kind of a surreal aspect to those faces, which isn't exactly what Jackson intended. He wanted us to experience the film as if we were experiencing the First World War, which is of course impossible, but it seems that with all of the bells and whistles associated with this 21st century technology, there are still some aspects that cannot recreate the hugely haunting sense that comes across in those original films in the form that they were first screened in back during World War One.
51551 for your texts at RTE History Show is our Twitter handle. Ciara, how is any of this different, though, from, say, for example, the restoration of an old master like Caravaggio's The Taking of Christ, which was extensively restored, as I recall, I think, by the National Gallery after it came from the Jesuit house in Leeson Street and was brought to the National Gallery before it went on display. So how is that any different?
Well, look, archives use restoration of film in many cases. It's a standard practice. So adjusting of frame rates is not unusual. Many archives work with frame rates. They grade colour footage, for example, when they're digitising film. They might also try to counteract over underexposure. However, Jackson goes a little bit beyond this. He uses actors to lip sync extra dialogue. He adds other dramatic sound effects. He enhances the battle sequences quite spectacularly. particularly, because the original footage, of course, was just too distant. But there's something different in the sense that, and I think Cassandra outlined this in her comments, that what Jackson is doing is not restoration. Archives restore film to bring it back to its original screening conditions. So what they try to do is they try to present film in the same crisp, clear conditions that it might have been screened in the cinema on nitrate film when they digitise and when they restore and clean film. And of course, film degrades every time it goes through a projector. So there are certain restoration processes that have to happen so that we can restore the best version and preserve it for posterity. But Jackson is doing something else. There's a range of manipulative digital sound effects and other visual effects that he's employing that are nothing really to do with restoration.
So, Orla, based on what Ciara is saying, should this be nominated for an Oscar in a fiction category rather than a documentary category?
Well, I think the term documentary probably is a little bit problematic, and I think midway when they're discussing...
And given the fakery involved in the original material, you could say that as well, couldn't
you? True. What is truth when you're talking about photography and cinema? But I think midway through the film documentary, they're trying to depict the going over the top scenes, and because there was no actual footage of that, they use illustrated London News and illustrated War News, and the use of this is given the equal truth with the photographic, whilst they are illustrated depictions of hand-to-hand combat, which are perhaps quite Victorian, and I would consider them quite problematic, put in there amidst the photographic material as well.
I agree with Orla. he has to use this because he's trying to create this feeling about a war that's happened that could never be photographed by the original cameraman. And one piece of film that he continuously uses and he repeats is a group of soldiers in a laneway about to go over the top on the 1st of July, and they're all from the Lancashire Fusiliers, and he continuously uses this in the same segment with the illustrated War News images. And we know that those men, 10 minutes after the film footage was made, went over the top and 60% of them were killed. And if he had just focused on that group of men and actually had focused on the Lancashire Regiment and actually explained who they were and the fact that these men are only 10 minutes from looking at about to die, that would have been an amazing cinematic moment and have taken this from being a documentary to maybe a film. And I think it's a missed opportunity because he keeps coming back to the interviews from the 1960s, which were used in the original BBC programme on the history of World War One. Which the Imperial War Museum worked with the BBC at the time. And he continuously refers to these recordings. And I think he could have used the film, this kind of supports what Orla is saying, if he had gone into the history of how the cameramen had worked on and the scenes that they were filming, there was pieces there that he could have used and using a narrator had brought to life and told a fuller story, I felt.
But, I mean, you talked about the jingoism. Mm-hmm. Do you not think that those interview segments that are used throughout, which come from BBC Imperial War Museum interviews done in the 1960s, that they are an antidote, that to some extent they are talking against some of the images that we're seeing?
He uses them very cleverly, but you do have to remember, again, when we look at oral historians and how we carry out interviews, is that these men are all in their 60s and 70s and in the 1960s, and you get it in the last 5 minutes, a lot of them are very, very angry. They talk about not being remembered when they come home, their families not talking to them about the war. And this World War One generation, by the 1916s, had felt in many ways that World War Two had come to dominate the narrative in Britain, that was the national narrative, it was all about World War Two. And there's an anger, and you can hear it in their voices. They do feel, after everything that they went through, losing 750,000 men, even by 1920, 21, their story is forgotten, and it's definitely forgotten by 1939. And that's the kind of anger. So you do have to be careful when you look at those and listen to those histories, and you have to contextualise and explain who these men are and what the experience they experienced after the war.
Right. Ciara, just to come back to the notion of the restoration, the comparison between the restoration of this film, if you can call it that, or colourisation, but restoration substantially, and the restoration of a painting. The fact of the matter is that when a painting is restored, that's it. It's changed forever. In this case, the original material still survives. So, Peter Jackson hasn't done any damage.
No, and of course, the other side of the debate, when we're thinking about this change in context of the material, is that Peter Jackson's film will bring the original films to a new audience and perhaps inspire viewers to become more interested in learning about the First World War. But again, some critics have argued that it's still pandering to viewers who don't have enough of an attention span for those original archive films, and that they have to be made more entertaining for them. And I really see Peter Jackson's other work evident in this rather than the source material. So it's an epic film. It's full of battle scenes and special effects. It's very, very different from the original context in which these films were produced. And of course, coming back to the notion that Jackson is manipulating these films that were already manipulated. I mean, another film that's used in Jackson's documentary is a film that came out in two versions. It's called Firstly With the Irish at the Front, and secondly With the North and South Irish at the Front. And it was a propaganda film meant to celebrate the contribution of Irish soldiers during the First World War. And again, that's a film whose context is lost in the overall documentary. The average viewer is never going to know anything about that. It would be nice to think that Jackson's really fascinating documentary brings this material to new audiences, but without a context for that, I don't see how that can happen. And I did look at the film's website to see, was the context there? Were the films listed? Were the filmmakers listed? Were even the audio interviews referred to in that website? And they're not at the minute. Maybe they will be in the future. But I think if there's going to be an educational context around this material, there should have been more work done in framing it in a certain way and opening up some of these debates for discussion.
Lara, just in conclusion, contrast what Peter Jackson has done with the material and what was done with the material from the Irish Revolutionary Struggle, which is now available online
on the IFI player. Yeah, no, I mean,
because it was digitally enhanced.
Yeah, but what was wonderful about the newsreel footage from that project is that's gone back to the original. So you've gone back to the nitrate, and you see that sharpness. You can see the film as it was seen 100 years ago. It doesn't need to be colorized. You can see how sharp it is. And that's what, ironically, the Imperial War Museum did 10 years ago with the Battle of the Somme. They went back to the originals. They'd come, the black and white version of that that's now screened is perfect. You can see all the detail. And that, in many ways, is due to the European Union, because large amounts of European funding was used to restore that material 10 years ago.
Right, and that's not going to be happening after the 29th of March, but that's another story altogether. Apparently, you were telling me that the film actually is coming back into cinemas. It's available on Blu-ray and DVD, but there are going to be more cinematic releases.
Yes, it's
later
proved
on
to be so hugely popular, and the feedback has, I think most film critics have given it 5 stars. It's going to be brought out in the next couple of months.
So you would probably get, if you're interested, you would probably get a chance to see it in full Technicolor in an actual cinema rather than just watching it on television. But it has been nominated this week for a BAFTA for Best Documentary. Ciara Chambers, Orla Fitzpatrick and Lara Joy, welcome. Thank you very much. And Orla's coming back to talk to us later about something entirely different. Many thanks for joining us this evening to talk about They Shall Not Grow Old. After the break, Nan O'Nagle, The Life and the Legacy.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. It's 51551 for your texts. Nan O'Nagle was born in Cork in 1718 as the founder of the Sisters of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin Mary. She was a pioneer of Catholic education in Ireland. But hers was a global vision, as she wrote to a friend in 1769.
My schools are beginning to be of service to a great many parts of the world. If I could be of service in saving souls in any part of the globe, I would be willing to do all in my power.
And as we'll hear, those are words that would prove quite prophetic for Nan O'Nagle, as the order she founded would spread around the world. And that quote demonstrates the outward-looking vision she had, a vision which was exceptional for a Cork woman in the 1780s. I'm joined now by Deirdre Raftery, historian of education at University College Dublin, who, along with Katrina Delaney and Catherine Nolan Roebuck, is the author of the recently published book Nan O'Nagle, The Life and Legacy. You're very welcome to the History Show. The name, first of all, Nano. Where does Nano come from?
A pet name that her parents put on her, a little pet name deriving from her first name, Honora.
Honora. So she was Honora Nagel. And you were telling me during the break, Honora was a common enough name
in Ireland, yes, at that time, for girls.
And certainly has disappeared without trace, more or less, since then. I'm sure we will get texts in from millions of Honoras giving the lie to that. She came from a prosperous family, and yes, that's very, very important to this story.
Mm, yes, she did. The Nagels were wealthy, they were landowners, they were also land leasers. And they were very well known in Munster. They lived all along the Blackwater Valley, and that was where she was born. Much of their wealth would have derived from the letting of land and also from orcharding. They were big apple growers, and they made quite a substantial fortune out of
that. So you're basically saying to me that Nano Nagel's money came from cider.
Well,
a lot of it.
Certainly their apples were used, exported for the cider business. Yes.
Now, although they were wealthy, they were Catholic, so yes, that would not necessarily have protected them from the dangers of living in penal law Ireland.
Mm, yes, I think that's true. It was certainly probably more true for Nano herself as a woman, as a young girl, than some of her uncles, for example. The male members of her family lived a lot of the time out of the country. They lived in Flanders, some of them lived in Paris. And that was a way of protecting themselves and also protecting their financial interests. So she was more, I suppose, acutely aware of the dangers when she started to found her first schools in Cork, the dangers of attracting attention to herself as a Catholic woman who was trying to provide education for the poor, who should not have been going to schools at all.
And part of her money, I'm fascinated by how some of that money came to her, because it came as a consequence of one of her uncles choosing to die intestate, so without leaving a will.
Yes.
How did that work and what was that all about?
Well, it was a practice that was commonly used by Catholics who were not allowed under legislation to leave a will, leaving their wealth to their offspring or to their relatives. And they would leave their wealth in a trust, and the trustees who managed the estate would devolve the wealth as had been requested of them. And it was requested by her uncle, who died intestate, who was also quite wealthy, that his fortune, a considerable amount of it, would go to his niece, Nano. And that was what, as they would say nowadays, kind of leveraged the whole business for her. She then goes into the world of property and development, as we would now call it. But in fact, that's what she was doing. She started to build.
We'll come back to that in a few moments, but I want to talk about her education, because she was educated in France. Was that common for wealthy Catholics at the time to send their children to the continent, and how did it work, and how long would they have stayed there?
It would have been common for certainly Catholics of the social class that the Nagels belonged to. It would have been common to slip your sons and daughters out of the country.
Slip being the operative word.
Yes, yes. You were not going to do this publicly, but you would want them to have an education, a scholarly education for your sons. To do this for your daughters was a little more unusual, not extremely unusual, but it would be very easy with daughters to educate them at home with a governess. But to give your son a classical education, you would have sent him to Spain or France, for example, to eventually to some of the Irish colleges. For Nano and for her sisters, it would have not been unusual to just have a tutor. Yeah. So her parents made a very clear decision that they would send her out of the country with her sister to school, and she was probably away at school for 3 or 4 years at one stretch. And
so this wasn't like an Erasmus scholarship.
It certainly wasn't.
This was for the duration.
No, and she would have been young, so parents at that point, when they said goodbye to the child and sent the child away to school, even if they were going somewhere as close as, we'll say, the Bar Convent in York, you were still saying goodbye to the child for 3 or 4 years, or maybe even longer.
And the alternative, I mean, one alternative obviously was tutoring at home, but if they were sent to schools, there was presumably a risk of being proselytised.
Well, there would have been no question that a family like the Nagels would have sent their daughters to a day school or a Protestant school at that time in the country. There were charter schools and charity schools that were operating that would have educated the daughters of the poor, including the Catholic poor who would have been proselytised. But for a family like the Nagels, it would have been a Catholic tutor or nothing. Mm. But you would be educated by your mother.
So she comes back to Ireland in 1746. Mm. And does she begin working in education? Does she begin working with the poor almost immediately? Mm.
Her life takes a few turns when she comes back. Firstly, she's in Dublin for a while. Her mother and her sister die. She was very close to one of her sisters, and this sister dies. She then goes, as a lot of single women at the time would have had to do, to live with one of her brothers in Cork. So she's back in Cork. And she is influenced by servants on her brother's estate whose children are not educated, Catholic servants. And she is influenced at that point to try to set up poor schools. And she does that surreptitiously at first. Then there is another phase of her life. Again, the records of this are very scant, where she goes back to France and spends time in France and probably made her novitiate, as it would have been called, probably was considering entering a religious congregation herself, but in fact did not do that.
Yeah, that's one of the very interesting things about her. Again, we'll maybe talk about that a little bit later. But what she does do, one of the things she does, is she brings a group of nuns from Paris to Ireland.
Yes,
the Ursuline nuns.
She brings the Ursulines, and that is an extraordinary innovation. That's a major step to establish the Ursulines here in 1771. We are finally having a Catholic congregation back in the country that will run a school for girls, schools for girls.
Are the penal laws beginning to peter out at
this
stage?
Yes, absolutely. There would have been a relaxation. But we can gather from the way she talks about the job of building that convent that she did it quite secretively. And she writes to some of the other sisters, "We cannot do exactly as we please in this country." So I think myself, to some degree, she was aware that as a woman, a single woman of her age, to be working so independently, supervising the builders, as she was, supervising the construction, making decisions about what this convent would look like. I think there was a gendered question here for Nano Nagel.
But also the Ursulines worked out to some extent, but not entirely, because they were in enclosed order.
Yes. Now, she would have known this. I don't think perhaps she realised the extent to which their rule of enclosure would impact on what she wanted to do. She wanted sisters who could be out among the poor. She had seen this in Paris, walking nuns, as they were often called, who would be out among the poor. And the rule of enclosure that the Ursulines had would not allow this. They were running a poor school in their compound, as it were.
But the poor had to come to them.
Yes, but she wanted to be out because she realised you needed to actually find the children.
And that's where the Sisters of the Presentation come from.
That's where her impetus for that comes from. Very quickly, after spending between £3,000 and £4,000 of her fortune building the Ursuline Convent, she starts all over again.
And the mission, very clearly, of the Presentation Order of Nuns, as far as Nano Nagel was concerned, was focusing on the education of the poor, not the middle classes, not the wealthy, very specifically the poor. Does she at any point during her own lifetime resile from that?
That was her absolute mission, and that's what she was very clear about. And that was the purpose and function of the congregation always. That is how it identified itself. Different parts of its mission across time, particularly in the 19th century, when they went out, presentations went out of the country, their rules and regulations and ways of running convents had to change and had to modify. But from Nano's perspective, they were a congregation for the poorest of the poor.
She strikes me as a woman who had no intention of ever kowtowing to anybody. We've already addressed the fact she doesn't actually take vows as a nun herself until almost the end of her life.
She's not going
to kowtow to a mother superior or whatever. But also, she rubs up against Catholic bishops in Cork, one Catholic bishop.
She does. There are a number of incidents in the small quantity of records of her life. There are a number of times when she rubs up against the hierarchy. She rubs up against Dr. Butler, the Catholic Bishop of Cork, at one point when he says, when she's building her Ursuline convent, "Would you consider courting the approval of the Protestant ascendancy?" And she refuses, absolutely. When Moylan, Dr. Moylan, asks her to reconsider this idea of starting a convent for the poor, no question, she said, I'll take my wealth elsewhere.
She died in 1784. She has been in delicate health, but I think she suffered from tuberculosis. But she spent quite a while in remission, didn't she?
She did. She had a long remission. We know from her letters that she was coughing blood at an early stage. But she clearly had a long remission, which is perfectly medically possible. And then her consumption, we have evidence that her consumption was what killed her later in her life. She would have been among children that would have been tubercular and among other sisters, many sisters in convents, many people were tubercular. And she would have been quite easily exposed to TB.
After her death, then, the presentation order begins to spread worldwide to some rather uncomfortable places, like Newfoundland, for example, and the Dakotas, North and South Dakota in the USA. Not particularly hospitable places.
No, their first mission out of the country, 1833, very early, they go to Newfoundland at the request of a bishop, Bishop Fleming, who comes to Ireland questing for vocations, as they used to call it. And he arrives up at the convent door in Galway and persuades some of their strongest and most useful sisters to go back with him on board a ship for that horrendous ship journey the whole way to Newfoundland. They're at sea for almost a couple of months, by which time it actually was assumed back in Ireland that the ship had been lost, because many months pass and no letter is ever received to say that they've arrived. And as was the custom of the time, the sisters in Galway burned their vows and had a requiem mass for the women who had left for Newfoundland.
Given them up for dead.
Given them up for dead. And then suddenly a letter finally arrived to say that they were there and they were surviving, but it was pretty inhospitable.
They went to hospitable. I note, for example, that they were in San Francisco in 1854. Yes. San Francisco in 1854 was a pretty roisterous, boisterous kind of place, not the safest place in the world for any female to be.
Sure. Another very difficult mission. In fact, many of that first pioneering, that pioneering group that went to San Francisco left. They came back. They were not able for it. But the mother foundress out there was able for it. She held her ground and seemed to have been well able to stand up to both the conditions she was working in and the people she had to work with, and made a great success of that mission. But it was another very difficult one.
One of many, but if you want to find out about some of the other places that they went to, you can read the book, which is called Nanonagel, The Life and the Legacy. And the legacy part is particularly important. Deirdre, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
For joining us. The book is by Deirdre Raftery, Katrina Delaney and Catherine Nolan Roebuck, and it's published by Irish Academic Press. After the break, we'll be previewing a new conference on the history of Dublin Markets.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 151551 for your text. Returning now to an important aspect of Dublin's past, its markets. Markets, of course, as well as having a long and varied history, are also an important part of the city of Dublin's character.
Fighting
a pound of
carrots, eating
a pound of spring. The smallest butcher shop in Ireland, but we give you honest to God value now.
Fighting a pound of carrots.
2 pounds of chops now for 50 pence.
Onions are carrots.
2 carrots, onions are spruce, say
hello. And we give you 2 pounds of chops, not 1 pound. 2 pounds of chops now for 50 pence.
Fighting a pound of carrots.
2 pounds a chop for 50 pence, that's a while ago. Voices from the RTE archives, the sound of street vendors heard in the 1974 RTE television programme, The Humours of Moor Street. Dublin has long been a city of markets, from the 17th century Ormond Market to the Dandelion Market of the 1970s, right up to today. Generations of citizens and visitors have bought and sold, they've haggled and bargained with street sellers and traders. And on the 26th of January, there's a conference taking place at the Wood Quay venue in Dublin 8, exploring the long history of the capital's markets. It's called Buying and Selling, Dublin's Markets 1500 to the Present. And I'm joined by two of the speakers at that conference, Kieran McCabe of University College Dublin, and back again, double jobbing, Orla Fitzpatrick of the National Museum of Ireland. Kieran, your talk looks at Dublin's second-hand clothes markets and public health in early 20th century Dublin. Was there a big trade, first of all, in secondhand clothes at around the turn of the century?
There was quite a vibrant trade in secondhand clothes or cast-off clothes in Dublin in the late 19th, early 20th century. I suppose a lot of people living in Dublin were employed in very casual, unskilled types of labour. Poverty was rife in the city, so secondhand clothes played quite a large part of in the lives of working class people in Dublin. And some of the main markets were, for example, on the north side, Mary's Lane and Mary's Abbey, and also over off Moore Street you had Riddle's Row and the Anglesey Market, where the ILAC Centre now is, and on the south side in particular you had the Patrick Street Market.
And what were the public health concerns?
The public health concern mainly arose from the mid to late 19th century, increasing knowledge around the nature of disease, move away from the old miasma, the air is polluted kind of disease, to it's bacteria that's causing the disease, and the appreciation that that can be spread in people's clothes. So in the overcrowded slums and tenements of Dublin City, the fear was these were ideal fever nests where disease could be propagated and passed on.
So you could basically buy typhus?
Yes.
A typhus jacket?
A typhus jacket, if you want. Typhus and smallpox was another one that people readily believed that could be passed on easily in secondhand clothes.
Oh, absolutely. One market you're looking at in particular is the Ivy Market. Tell us about the Ivy Market. First of all, for anybody who doesn't know Dublin particularly well, locate the Ivy Market for us.
The Ivy Market building is just off Francis Street in the Liberties, and the south side of the Liffey. And the market came about because of a slum clearance scheme around the vicinity of St Patrick's Cathedral at the turn of the century. And part of the clearance of slums around Patrick Street, Nicholas Street, Francis Street, and the construction of what we now know as the Ivy Trust housing that people will know in that area, part of that was getting street traders off the actual street on Patrick Street and into a purpose-built facility, i.e. the Ivy Markets, where they could sell their clothes under the watchful eye of the authorities and Dublin Corporation, but also crucially there were disinfectant chambers, so people were required to wash and disinfect their clothes before selling them, again mitigating the threat of disease in the community.
It's described as in the 1900s as a philanthropic market. What sense was it a philanthropic market?
Because the
market?
Site itself was donated to Dublin City by Lord Ivy, who was Edward Cecil Guinness. He was of the Guinness Brewing family, and as well as being a very successful businessman, he was a very benevolent philanthropist, and he initiated the Ivy Trust housing as well as the Ivy Market.
And was it just clothes that were sold at this market, or was anything and everything sold?
No, there was a dry market, so the clothes, and then there was a wet market, as it was known, where meat, fish and vegetables were also sold.
Right. Orla, you're going to be looking at the Cumberland Market. Where is or was the Cumberland Market?
Cumberland Street North, it runs parallel to O'Connell Street, and I'm going to be looking at a series of photographs that were taken in the late 1960s by a woman called Eleanor Wilcher, street photography documentary, and I catalogued that collection about 20 years ago, and this series of photographs really struck me because of just the array of material that was for sale. Children selling bits and pieces, everything laid out on the street. So it's very much ad hoc, and it's still on the go, it's still going, but very much reduced. And I'm quite interested in looking as to whether the introduction of licences and the formalisation of things, whether that reduces the market or whether it controls or improves it. So these photographs are really stand out in their composition, and they say a lot about what was in the houses in Dublin, what was for sale. They are indicative of poverty, but then also it's quite a mixed audience on the street that are buying and selling.
And Eleanor Wilcher, was she the woman who took these photographs? Was she Irish?
She was Irish, yeah, and her collection is in the National Photographic Archive. She took her photographs with a Rolleiflex camera, square format negatives, and a really talented photographer.
And it doesn't just include the Cumberland Market. She had lots
Not
of
at
photos.
All. She had a very keen eye for architectural detail, the destruction of George in Dublin.
So it's almost like a 1960s Lawrence collection, is it? Or
that's true. That's true.
Like that?
She walked around every weekend taking these photographs, and she knew where what would throw up a very interesting sort of lively scene. So the Cumberland Street ones really struck me in that they were very vibrant.
And they're in the National Library's photographic archive. We put a link on our own website to some of the images that are online. All of this, Patrick, Kieran McCabe, thank you both very much for joining us this evening, both speaking as part of that conference on Saturday, 26th of January. It's called Buying and Selling Dublin's Markets 1500 to the Present, and it's taking place at the Wood Quay venue in Dublin 8. And by the way, in conjunction with the conference on the previous evening, at the Dublin Civic Trust, there's a free screening of Bananas on the Breadboard, a documentary celebrating life and traditions in the markets area of Dublin's northwest inner city. We'll put all those details on our website, rte.ie/history. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. My thanks to Kieran Dunn on sound, our researcher Liz Gillis, and our reader tonight, Niamh Hayes. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.